Welcome to The Art of Construction, the podcast dedicated to helping you grow your business. Together, we'll explore the world of construction with some of the best minds of the industry. Your host, Evan Tilley, a micro-influencer and sometimes disruptor, will take you on a journey that will lead your business to the next level.
What's up, Art of Construction Tribe? Devin Tilley here, and I'm so excited to be talking about construction technology and robots, but more importantly, us humans that make this all work today. We have an awesome conversation, and from my perspective, it's all about the synergy of blending offsite and onsite construction and figuring out what is this right kit of parts. And what we're going to be talking about today is blending the humans and the robots for the best handoffs for a cooperative working environment. And Tribe, I raise my hand and say, us humans can be challenging, right? It's hard to replicate a human because, hey, we're kick-ass amazing machines, right? And we don't want to have all of our construction execution reliable on that integrator or those robots. And how do we figure out how we blend this stuff together? So from my point of view, and who we're going to talk about in interview is these guys are great collaborators. And the key, which is the future of construction, is blending the humans and the robots all together, as we've been talking a lot about with companies like Trimble and alike, of what is this one source of truth to execute that one thing. And our one thing on here on the Art of Construction is shelter, right? And so innovation is the key to the future of the Art of Construction. And as I was doing our pre-interviews, the 300,000 foot word that kept coming up is productivity. And man, we're struggling with that in the Art of Construction, right? So that's what we're going to talk about today. And I'm super excited to have Dwight Morgan, who he'll talk to us about. He's not the construction guy. He is the robot guy, but he knows a lot about construction. And I'm super excited to get into his mind and have him talk about the process iteration through his background in automation, as well as we're going to have David Osher, who he says he's the kitchen sink and he's the guy that's coming in and making this work. And so what we're going to be talking about is blending robots, or what we've been talking about, the new tech, with us humans, the tried and true practices to make this all work. And so who we get to have into the studio today is a killer new company that's called Offsite Tech. And what they do is they automate offsite construction. And give credit where credit is due is Alice from Brick and Mortar Ventures made the introduction, and they partnered together. And what Brick and Mortar Ventures is all about is disrupting the way we design, construct, and maintaining the built world. So they're a great VC company. And thanks, Alice, for making the introduction to these guys. And they have such a cool story to tell. And we're going to go through the evolution of how us humans can collaborate with the robots. Lock and load, Tribe. Dwight, what's your favorite beverage?
Well, I'm easy. It's a classic Coca-Cola, okay?
That's two in a row.
It's got to be 37 degrees Fahrenheit.
A specific Coca-Cola. I've had a few specific, like I had one guy that was like, it's Coke, but it's all the different kinds. It's restaurant this way and fizz this way. It's like, wow, there's some people when they're into it, they know the different ways it should be done, right?
I did some work with Coca-Cola down in the headquarters in Atlanta once, and they have obviously Coca-Cola machines all over their headquarters, and they specifically have a target temperature, and I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure it was 37 Fahrenheit. And that is like the target temperature to drink the product at. So I learned a lot from those guys in some of the automation projects we worked with Coca-Cola.
There you go. What's the favorite place you've traveled?
You know, it's hard for me to pick one. I'm going to say Dubai and South Africa. Those two were like tied. I just thought those were great places.
Wow. Give us what's a story that comes to mind from one of those travels?
You know, at Dubai, I think the coolest thing about it is from a construction perspective, I think about like Nelson Mandela, where he says everything is impossible until it gets done, right? Mm-hmm. I might have misquoted him, but to some extent, that's what he said. And when you look at Dubai, everything there appears to have been impossible. They've built these skyscrapers and ski resorts in the middle of a 130 degree desert. And everything that you thought would be impossible in that environment, you know, hot, arid, desert, they made possible. And they did it through construction engineering and building science and just, you know, collaboration with some of the smartest people in the world to build some of the most unbelievable buildings, you know, some of them out in the ocean. And it's quite interesting.
Awesome. And what do you like to do outside of the construction silos we're going to talk about breaking down that we passionately call the art of construction?
You know, I'm a boring guy, but I have always been in love with photography. And I started out as the photography editor in high school doing the yearbook, and I just stuck with it. My aunt taught me about cameras. She used to travel to Japan when she brought me back a camera for a gift, and I fell in love with it when I first got my first digital 35 millimeter camera. And today that's what I do. I go shoot. I do street shooting. I do landscape shooting, and I rent studios. And sometimes I do fashion and glamour shooting, but that's my love. I love photography.
Awesome. Well, we got to know a little bit about Dwight, our robot guy, and we'll get to hear his story. But we also have the pleasure of having Dave, the CEO, in the studio, Art of Construction. Dave, what's your favorite beverage?
Lemonade.
Lemonade.
Fashion, homemade, fresh squeezed lemonade.
Oh, there you go. And tell us about the favorite place you've traveled.
I'd say St. Lucia in the Caribbean. It was by far my favorite place to be.
Give us one story from St. Lucia.
Well, I guess it's the whole story, right? My wife and I spent most of our 10 days there outside of the all-inclusive resort that we had, eating on the street and hanging out on you know, some pretty cool beaches with, you know, the local people, and getting to know that island was experience in itself. It was an amazing place to be.
Awesome. And what do you like to do out when you're not working in construction?
Build fast cars.
Oh, there we go. Tell us about one of your cars.
Probably the most difficult one I've done. I've been building since I was 16, but I just recently, about three, four years ago, I did a 1982 Porsche 911, a ground up restoration, and actually ended up turning into a track car. And learning German engineering was an interesting process. They build different than American car builders, for sure.
Cool. Well, Dwight, tell us your story that led you to being the chief manufacturing officer for Offsite Tech.
Hey, thanks, Devin. So I think give a little bit of background on myself. I have been in automation for about 35 years. I started out in college, and at that point, I went to Cornell University, and there was absolutely no talk about robotics in engineering school at that point. And there was none at an Ivy League institution. They had never thought about it. So I convinced one of my professors to get involved in robotics. I just felt drawn to it. I think it's because I was always a Lost in Space Star Trek fan. And I love those robots on those old 1970 films. And Cornell invested in a Rhino robot that looks like a bicycle. If you pull it up on the internet, it's laughable when you look at it today. And I went from tinkering around in the engineering labs with this very first educational robot to then graduating Cornell as a General Motors scholar. And I was going to go into manufacturing with General Motors in Michigan. And they had an initiative, which was to transform the automotive industry through automation, vis-a-vis through robotics. And Roger Smith, the then chairman, wanted to start up a company. And that company today has become the largest US-based robot company called Fanuc Robotics. I joined that team when there were only five of us. And we went down this journey that had never been walked before. And that is how to put in 10,000 robots into General Motors in 10 years. Today, a typical automotive plant in itself, one plant today, has 10,000 robots. So the initiative back then was 10,000 into the entire corporation in 10 years. So I participated in that manufacturing transformation, and I learned a lot about manufacturing and how to do projects successfully and how to do some projects not so successfully. One of the things we did at the joint venture was that even though it was a General Motors joint venture focused at making General Motors successful with automation, General Motors knew that the company had to stand on its own and that it had to have diversity in its marketplace. So we then started a general industry focus, which was to divest and create a 50% automotive versus 50% general industry focus on what we did in automation. I ran that particular group for about 15 years. And in that, we learned a lot about new applications. And when I left FANUC to start my own business, I took some of those learnings with me, which is how to do automation. I put that automation into my own business. After I sold that business, I went back into robotics again because it truly was where I was always most happy. And I went to work at ABB, and that's a Swiss-based global robotics company out of Zurich. And I ran their US business for robotic applications. And one of their initiatives at ABB was in fact to look at new industries that had not prior to that been focused on automation. And one of those industries was construction. So I had about 200 engineers that worked in my team. And we went and looked at a whole different types of applications. We did iPhone assembly. We did Tyson chicken deboning. We did laptop assembly for Dell. So a wide diversity of applications. But then we came across this initiative led by Autodesk. And I think many of the listeners know who Autodesk is. Everybody knows what AutoCAD software is and Revit and all the extra modules that plug into AutoCAD. It's basically the mainstay software platform for designing and building and construction. So Autodesk wanted to lead the way as a think leader. And in that thought leader, I guess is really the better way to say it, they set up a center in Boston called the Autodesk Build Center. ABB was a technology provider to that. And we provided them some of our industrial robots for Autodesk to then use to create these innovative, thought-driven ideas on how to use robotics to improve certain applications within construction. One of which was light gauge steel fabrication and framing for residential multifamily housing. I spent time at Autodesk, looked at what they had, was very impressed with it. And then we also realized that outside of Autodesk, there were other companies such as Katerra, as an example, you know, and other companies that wanted to automate their construction industry. And what I learned is by going and having my team work with these other customers in construction, we saw how they all were going to approach automation within construction from a different perspective. Each of them had their own perspective. Because when you never did automation in construction before, there's no path to follow. There's no right or wrong. There's only dreams and hopes that maybe we're going to take the right path and not fall off the cliff too far. So we watched all of these early adopters. When I say we, ABB watched these early adopters in construction automation, the Katerras, the Autovols, the Prescience of the world. And we came back and were able to have this vantage point where we looked at all the ways that they did it differently and some right, some wrong, some a little bit of right, some a little bit of wrong. And I sat back with a perspective and I said, you know what, this is a great idea. So I then spoke to our co-founder, Rick Admani. He had been in land development for quite some time. And he and I were also personal friends. We were business colleagues in the past. And we talked about what he had been doing for over a decade at JRN Development, developing land, real estate and infrastructure projects. And we talked about the next step for him. And that was to go vertical. And then he and I spoke and we said, let's go vertical together. And let me take what I've learned at ABB, and I've looked at all the companies that have done things as early adopters, and I think I have a better idea. I think I have one that leapfrogs us to ahead of where they were going as ABB customers. And we decided, Rick and myself, to found Offsite Tech. And that's basically how I got here. So I moved out of what I call Automation Alley, which is a strip of real estate in Michigan Many people don't realize that Michigan is not a car company. It's actually it's an automotion. It's an automotive and an automation industry is really what it is. And Automation Alley is where all of the robotic companies are headquartered. And they happen to be in Oakland County, Michigan. So I moved from Oakland County, Michigan down to Charlotte when we built this factory. And we called it Offsite Tech. And we've been doing this now for a little over 2.5, almost 3 years now. So that's how I got here. And
what a great story of all the, you know, I just finished recording our 250th episode on the Art of Construction. And people like Katera have been interviewed along the way. So many great perspectives that fit into where we're going with this thing. And I'm excited to get into this conversation about in talking through how the robots and work with your background. So thank you for sharing that. And we also have the perspective of Dave Osher. Dave, what is your story that led you to becoming the CEO of Offsite Tech?
So a little about my background and kind of that and how I got here. Actually, Rick Admani, our co-founder, was having dinner with two business colleagues of mine from another life and another business venture. And as Rick was talking through some of the challenges that Offsite Tech was facing in getting market traction and how to approach the market and deliver their product in an efficient way, right? And what does that conversation look like? My colleagues gave me a call and said, hey, you need to go down to Charlotte and check this out. At the time, I really was kind of trying to figure out what's my next move. So it was timely for me. But when I got here, it was enlightening to say the least. And it was more like, you know, sign me up. What do I need to do to participate in this thing? Yeah, my background is in real estate. I've been in the construction business since I was probably too young to be working, pushing a wheelbarrow for my grandfather kind of thing, and worked my way up through to run a large real estate development company. We had, you know, somewhere between $300 and $500 million a year in construction. Almost all of the projects that I managed myself were panelized projects in wood frame. Metal framing at that time was not so cost effective because of the tremendous amount of labor that had to be, you know, used to build the product. So cost became a challenge. And even thinking about it, wood frame works. It definitely increases productivity, but it has its limitations, in my opinion. When I saw what we have here at Offsite Tech, it seemed to me a no-brainer. It's kind of the next evolution, I guess, for using a word of an industry that hasn't really seen any forward progress in industrialization in probably 100 years. That is this significant. You know, even in the old panel plants, I've been doing this for panelizing buildings for 25 years. In the old panel plants, it's a very, I'll say, linear, kind of two-dimensional process, right? It's on tables and the machines, not robots, but machines function in one dimension. The difference walking into our plant is seeing things done in three dimensions. You know, that, from my perspective, was kind of the nail in the coffin to say, all right, this is definitely a game changer in the way we can deliver a product. And from a business case perspective, being able to deliver faster, more efficiently, and a higher quality product than what has been typically been delivered in this space in what I consider a very timely market, right? The market is saying that metal's good today, right? And that's not always been the case. You know, our company has gone the extra step and making sure that what we have is relevant to the marketplace. So it wasn't hard for me to decide to come here at all. Working with this team is nothing short of amazing.
Awesome. Well, I love that perspective of that you've been at this for a while from real estate development of this is just the way it's always been done, but looking at it from new perspectives. So Dwight, I want to start this thing off by saying, what is your definition of a robot?
That's a great question, Devin. So You know, the robotic industry came to be in the 1950s when the word robot was really first coined and used a lot. And Isaac Asimov was the first person that wrote a short story called I, Robot. And I think it's been remade with Hollywood within the last decade or so as well. And in that, it talked about, you know, a future world of what robots would look like. And in that short story, he defined the rules of robotics. And he didn't really say what a robot was. He just said, this is what a robot should do or not do. And it had to do with things like, you know, it had to follow certain rules. It couldn't injure a human. I'm not going to go through all the details, but if you just go type in Isaac Asimov definition of rules of a robot, you'll see a little bit the way the word robot was first used when it was first coined in 1950. Since then, there's been an industry association set up, and they really have talked to all the people in the industry that use automation, robotics, et cetera. And that's called the Robotics Industries Association out of Ann Arbor, Michigan, called RIA. And they define a robot as really a reprogrammable, multifunction manipulator that's designed to move parts or tools or specialized devices through some variably programmed motion path or position and to perform a variety of tasks. So it's a very good catch-all, and that is really the one that I supported and participated with RIA, because it was a collaborative, let's define what a robot is. So I'm going to steal their definition, because I was part of the team to help define it. And even though I didn't pick every word, you know, we basically went into a room and started throwing words up on the wall. And there was a facilitator at the trade association. And we all then took all these words that were thrown up on the wall and put them into that sentence, which is a reprogrammable multifunction manipulator designed to move materials, parts, tools, or specialized devices through programmed motions to perform a variety of tasks. And that really is the definition that we all have abide by today.
It's just fascinating for me to hear that, because I think of before I started going down this journey and going to school from all of Dwight's robots, is I was kind of like that Star Trek, like it's just this out there thing, right? So are robots only for big companies, or what's your take on the evolution of robots?
You know, I don't want to, this is a podcast, so nobody can see that I'm 175 years old, right? So I'm going to tell you, I'm going to date myself. So back in the early 1980s, when the first hydraulic Unimation robots were out there for sale, these were called industrial robots, because that was the first use for these machines that were built. The people said, you know, I'm going to build this technology, and they got to find a solution for it, right? It's a technology looking for a problem to solve. And the problem was industry. And the applications that these first robots were used in were dirty, the three Ds, dirty, you know, dull and dangerous. You know, boring as heck, just dull. Dirty, because nobody wants to work in a foundry and come home smelling like, you know, iron oxide from the foundry. And then dangerous, and no one wants to do those, right? But over time, at that time, robots were upwards of $100,000 for a single robot arm. And the reason I tell you that is that obviously would change which types of companies could use them. But today, because of motors becoming smarter and less expensive and computers, I mean, we've seen all the actual changes in cost of computerization and mechanization and robotics. Today, you can get a robot, if you type into the internet and look at like Sanyo or somebody, or even ABB, you can get a high-speed assembly robot that would be used by like Samsung or Apple for less than $10,000. The last time I looked, I saw them were like $7,000. So what does that mean? That now means that companies that built cars that sold for $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 would have been before the only people that would look at a $100,000 robot. Now, companies like even pizza companies, one of our most unique customers is a company called Zoom pizza. I think the best way to pronounce it so that people can find it is Zumi, right? Z-U-M-E, Zumi Pizza out of California. They actually launched an ABB robotic application with a web app where you could go on to their website, buy a pizza. They made really good pizzas, amazing pizzas. And the robots actually made the crust, put down the sauce, loaded the oven, and put it in a box. So that's a startup company in a footprint of a service center that took robotics from the industrial only big business all the way down to a small retail restaurant type setting. So today, industrial is a big, big market. Service robotics are now becoming big. Amazon probably has some of the highest density of robots in all of their fulfillment centers. Logistics is very big as well. Fulfillment of many Amazon packages are done robotically. Healthcare robots and labs are now done. Most of the COVID testing was done with industrial robots in Houston. And the new player, the one, the latecomer, is in fact construction robotics. So to answer the question in more direct terms, the costs have gone down from 10,000 to 7,000. So now any company, big or small, can benefit from robotic automation because the market has changed and matured so well that the cost has come down dramatically.
What a wonderful answer when I hear $100,000 to let's call it 10,000. That's a huge decrease. And on the flip side of that, if what the hourly rate, even to just be a starter wage for labor, just keeps going up, up, up. And that is the why I asked the question, and what a great answer. And so Dwight, on the next thing I want you to kind of talk about, so you've talked about the evolution of robots. What is your take to being successful in automation?
So one of the things that when we looked at construction as the target industry in which we're going to talk about how do you become successful in adapting automation to that specific industry, because each industry has its own unique element. So for example, if you're talking automotive, mass customization used to be a thing that car companies focused on. You used to be able to buy a black car with 5, 6, 7 or more different color interiors. And it became, oh, that's the way industry should be. But as those companies said, look, we need to get better at what we're doing. We need to automate better. If you have a robot that's painting a car, would you really want to paint it 32 different colors? Or would you want to paint it 6? Now, you might say 32 is a great answer, because then you're going to find somebody who wants one of those 32. But if you're trying to manufacture that and be productive, changing the color of that paint 32 times every shift becomes a real drain on productivity and cost. So at the end of the day, I think the key to success is understanding your process. And in the case of automation, you need to look at your industry, in this case, construction, and view it from the lens of manufacturing, okay? And in manufacturing, we people say, well, what's the manufacturing company? They build things, right? Well, they do more than that. They build things successfully, because if they don't, someone else is going to be building them in a low-cost country. So if they're in the U.S. building things, they do it through automation, but they also build it through a very simple concept, and that is whatever gets measured gets done, okay? Whatever gets measured gets done. We talked to a lot of construction companies that build multifamily and residential, and we'd ask them, like, what are your key performance indicators? What are your KPIs and metrics? And many of them had a very simple answer. It's number of housing starts per week. And we're like, that's it, huh? How many jobs you started this week? And they're like, yeah, that's how we measure things. So that gave us a lot of perspective on how the industry looked at things. But if you were looking at a manufacturer, manufacturing represents like 10% of the U.S. economy and about 15% of the global GDP. And it's fiercely competitive industry. And if you don't get better, continuously improve every single week and month, you will be out of business. It's just too cutthroat. It's too competitive. So the only way to do that is through KPIs. So what we looked at first is we said, we need to look at manufacturing automation. We need to look at construction as a manufacturing business and look at things like how, if we were manufacturing, what, how would we measure our success? Before we go and automate a bad process, right? If you automate a really bad process, what you get is an automated, faster, really bad process. So you end up, if you have a process which has a lot of scrap, you're going to have automatically produced scrap and you're going to have a lot more of it. So that's not going to get you anything. So what we talked about is let's identify the key performance indicators that we as a manufacturing related construction company should be governed by. And that was things like throughput, number of units produced in a given time every day. We're going to hold ourselves to that. You come to our plant, we get charts up on the wall, we get screens up there and says how many studs were produced today. We have a website, the guys can log in, all of our founders and managers can log in and say, machine number 7, how productive was it today? So measuring throughput, cycle time, how many people in construction think about, okay, how many linear feet of walls are we going to install today, right? Many, some do, but not many do as well. So cycle time is a manufacturing concept that made big benefits for us. Production attainment, number of times we met our production target out of the total number of times that we went after it. Things like costs that we avoided, you know, things such as repair and scrap and changeover time. You go from one house type, wall type, project type to the next. How much time did you waste changing over all of your equipment into that? So there's about 21 different metrics that we followed. And the answer to us would be, what is our, how do we become a successful automation company? One, know your process. Make your process better. Do not just jump into robotics and say, let's go ahead and throw robots in there to automate labor and take labor out, because that's going to give you a very, very small improvement. But it's to look at the entire fully integrated process as if it was a manufacturing process and cut out all the waste, set up the KPIs that you're going to measure yourself by every day, and then look at the elements of that that make up what I call the ecosystem. So when you look at construction, you look at the physical building, but there's so many steps before that, right? There's the entire design of that, the structural engineering, the mechanical, electrical, plumbing engineering. And what we learned is that prior to us launching this project, that many of those elements of the construction phases were disconnected. They ran on different software platforms. And when we worked with Autodesk at ABB, we realized that one of the things that they were focusing on was becoming the provider, not a provider, but the provider of the only integrated suite of software. Digital, what is software? It's a digital representation of what you're going to do. So they Autodesk came up with a fully digitized digital suite that took you from civil engineering to architecture to rendering to framing. And then we looked at what was missing. And then we teamed up with company partners of Autodesk like Struxsoft and MWF. And they helped us develop the back end, the manufacturing pieces, which didn't exist in the Autodesk offering. And we now have a complete continuous suite of solutions that allows us to digitalize everything associated with construction, from the site plan to the drone pictures that fly over the land that needs to be cut and graded, to the final product that we build, and then in between all of the manufacturing steps. And one of the epiphanies, the eye-openers to us is that automation is great. Digitalization is even greater, but mass customization, vis-a-vis like the story I talked about earlier, where you used to be able to get a car with 32 different trim colors. How do you do that in architecture? How do you do that in construction? And the answer is you can't have a BMW looking suite of buildings. And what I mean by that is all black interiors, right? All black steering wheels. For the most part, BMWs have a very, very limited interior trim package. And that makes manufacturing so much easier for them and so much more controllable. And because it's a gray car with black interior, it's a red car with black interior, or a red car with tan interior. Construction can't be like that, right? It has to be everybody's view of it. So we went back to the very, very, very fundamentals in architecture. And there was an architect that defined a theory called kit of parts. And in it, and they teach this today to every architect that goes to architectural school, says that every single construction, everything you build in the world, I don't care if it's a space station or a McDonald's or a hospital, can be broken down into reproducible small construction objects, such as a window opening, a door opening, a floor module, et cetera. And we refer to that as a KOP or a kit of parts. And to us, that was the missing link. Okay. Automation was out there. Robotics were out there. Digitalization was almost out there because it had all of the design, structural engineering, and modeling and framing. It didn't have the manufacturing piece. So we developed that along with MWF. But it still missed this, how do you customize these buildings? And the answer is, what does that mean, Dwight? I'm going to give Devin and David and myself 10,000 identical sized Legos, lock us each in a different room. We don't communicate. We can design three different projects out of these Legos. So Legos are truly kits of parts. And that's what we focused on, was a digitized CAD kit of parts. And that was the key to successful automation. And it was not just applying robots to get rid of labor. And it was not just digitalizing the entire portfolio of engineering, but it was coming up with a parametrically driven digital model represented through a kit of parts. I think those are the four legs to our stool of success.
So much there to unpack. We just did an interview with Gary Fleischer and Ken Semler and Audrey Grubesic. Our 250th episode was all about, we had them all previously talking about what we call system build lifestyle, or blending offsite and onsite construction, and talking through the M word of manufactured versus modular. And one of the key parallels of what you're talking about, of this, the automotive industry and the construction industry, they're different, but there's a lot of things we got to learn from each other of how that stuff works as construction's trying to pick up. And they talked about how on the job site, when it comes to safety and where we're going with this whole thing, it's scary to say how many 2x4s just get cut on site over somebody's foot. And they talked about how that's just kind of done when it just shows up at the job site, right? And in construction works that way. But you have to, if you were to do it that same way to automate that process, you'd have a lot of trash from what you're talking about. So much to think about when it comes to the kit of parts. What's your take when we're, you know, we just interviewed and doing a lot of work with companies like Trimble, where they talk about one source of truth. What's your take on blending that, you know, these digital twins, or your take on blending that model to the machine, Dwight?
Well, you know, it's a digital twin is an interesting concept. And you first of all need to be able to have the equipment that you deploy be able to have a digital twin driver. So when we look at digital twins, I think in construction, most people think about, well, I designed this building in Revit. I rendered it. It looks beautiful from the outside. And now I go inside and I place furniture. And let's say that it's a residential or a commercial project, or even a healthcare hospital project. And there's these applications that you see on TV with these Samsung, Motorola, AR, VR headsets. And now today you can walk through a building and do a virtual walkthrough. And that's now been adopted to residential home sales, you know, and what drove that really? Well, it was COVID, right? Nobody wants to sell homes, but nobody wants to go walk around them. So now you can do these digital walkthroughs. And we then said, you know what? We're partnered up with ABB, and they have a digital twin solution. So all of our manufacturing factory solutions can be viewed in the digital world. And what that allows is someone who understands the process, but doesn't understand the 20,000 lines of software that makes the process work, can look at that and say, you know what? I see some rooms for improvement. I can improve a KPI because there's some wait time on robot number 7, or there is just the way that the screw was put in could be done better. So visualization through digital twins, where the robot is actually feeding back real time a simulation, what's an actual digital simulation, meaning it's driven by the actual real time data in the factory. And that helps on continuous improvement, because that's what this is about, right? You can say, okay, our productivity was improved by X percent on day one. That's not good enough. It has to be improved every month, every next, you know, next month, next year. And that's how we improve this productivity of the construction industry. And digital twin is an important element to that, because it is visualization of the real world in digital space.
Yeah. Well said. And Dave, I want to kick it back to you. And you talked about at the beginning of this call about how, you know, traditionally wood framing, and you kind of alluded to, you know, steel and other things. What's your take when it comes to what you guys are doing around building science?
That's a great question. So what I find fascinating about our abilities, and it's integral to the way that we do things, right? We take at the front of the project, and as we're designing, you know, building codes, our favorite thing to deal with, are changing. And depending on where we're building and the client that we're building for, those codes kind of drive our structure and what we need to meet in that environment. So, you know, things like exterior sheathing, we've taken the steps as an organization to go ahead and look at the exterior sheathing of the structures that we're building, and giving the current market and where lumber pricing is going, is like, how can we solve for one of the greatest challenges in the market today? In fact, most of our current client base had been struggling with that issue. You know, lumber costs driving their project to a place where it became a stalled project. How do you deliver something in this market that is palatable from a financial perspective and allows owners to go ahead and move forward and get financing and close? Well, working through that challenge, we've come up with, you know, an exterior sheathing product that's a 4-in-1 product. This is the sheathing, a water, vapor, and shear product, as well as insulation. And it's something that doesn't exist in the market, and I wouldn't say it's a new product. It's an existing product used in a different way. We took the steps in looking at building science and said, well, what if we take this product and we test it? Will it work? Our manufacturing partner said, we don't see why not, but we're not going to do it. So we did it, and we sent the product through that testing, and the test results were remarkable as far as I'm concerned, because it exceeds what we could do with even, you know, with OSB or plywood, which are the mainstays in exterior sheeting. But this also allows us to meet an insulated value and eliminate labor on site by not having to seal the joints in the field. We could do it in the factory. And so the science behind what we deliver is deep. It's meaningful, because in order for us to meet those building codes and requirements, we have to go through the science and the math to make sure that the product that we're developing is relevant to the projects that we're trying to build.
Love it. Love it. So Dwight, as we've been talking through the evolution of this, with your experience in robots, what is the key for them being successful?
I really think that after you have a honed, improved process, just like Dave was talking about, which is a 4-in-1 sheathing product. And what we mean by that is it's one board, one sheathing product that takes the does the function of four. Think about what we've done by going into 4-in-1. If you were to automate it using standard sheathing approaches, you would put down four different products. So the real answer there is that we would have automated it with four times as much capital, potentially four times as long of a cycle time. And it would be a much bigger plant because we had to have four times as much of the equipment. And you can see where the numbers just multiply. So by coming up with a good automated process first, we then applied and said, we feel that we now have a process worthy of automation. Just because you can see it and just because you can envision it doesn't mean it's an optimized process. So after going through what stays in, what goes out, what needs to change dramatically to make the process better, and we then freeze the process, we then took that and said, let's go in and go to the next step of what is it going to take to be successful. And the real thing has to be digitalization. That's a key piece. Collaboration, which means don't try to get rid of every single human being, like there's some sort of a, you know, problem in your business. They're not. They're tremendously tremendous assets, and they're the reason why you have a business. It's about people and not equipment. So collaboration with humans, digitalization, a optimized process, and then honestly, a suite of powerful data-driven partners that provide you with plug-and-play solutions to what they do. And that's how we went to ABB, was because they had the most integrated portfolio of components needed to do automation, because automation is about movement, right? It's about moving motors and conveyors and chains and robot arms. It's not just about a robot arm sitting in the middle of a plant. It's all of this other equipment, screwdriver guns, welding equipment, dispensing systems for adhesives and sealants, and vision systems for doing in-process checking. And it's one of the things we've seen is we've seen some of our competitors build plants like ours for $100 million, which is a mind-boggling expense. And we built this plant for a small portion of that. Let's call it less than $10 million. So once you optimize and have the right partners, you really can create something which is that can be duplicated on a regional basis. It's very difficult to build a plant that's $100 million. It's easy to make 10 plants that are $10 million each and do them regionally. That's really scaling the solutions that we came up with. And that was part of our idea, which is let's not throw all the money in the world at some solution and then show the world that we have the most high-tech, Star Trek-looking plant in the world that is going to be very difficult to reproduce capital-wise. Instead, we said, what's the target price? What's the productivity? What's the market? And light gauge steel became a real important piece of enabling this automation, because timber is just not a very good material to try, first of all, to build with, and second of all, to automate around. It is organic. It likes to move. It likes to dry. It likes to rot. It likes to burn. It likes to create dust when you cut it. All the things about it really are not very good in terms of being a material of choice. Okay, it's just not a great material of choice for an automated construction. And if you think about it, the Empire State Building is framed in metal. Nobody bats an eye there. When people drive past hospitals that are being built and airports that are being built and amusement parks and hotels, we all look up and what do we see? Steel. We see steel, light gauge steel for the most part. And nobody questions that. They all say, wow, yeah, that's a really nice building. It's going to be there forever. But then we go ahead and look at residential, multifamily, affordable housing, and somehow we demystified the value of steel, and that somehow by going from commercial to non-commercial vis-a-vis residential, you've got to change your core building material. And that's the myth that we said we need to break. The myth was steel is more money. And it is a myth. It is not more money. It is 7 times stronger. It lasts for over 100 years. Some say 350 years. It is a recycled material. It is not created by knocking down trees. It is created by salvaging scrapped automobiles. That's where our steel comes from. It is resilient to storms. It is resilient to 190 mile an hour Category 5 winds. It's resilient to a storm. So our success was automation, collaboration automation, meaning that it works along with humans, digitalization of the entire model from start to finish, and picking the right construction materials vis-a-vis light gauge steel, advanced sheathing, this 4-in-1 product, and using that as the basis for the construction of everything we make.
So if I'm understanding all this right, it's taking the right process first that can be automated, take the right materials that are putting this all together. And Dwight, what is that key collaborative, like operational way that humans and robots need to work together?
Yeah, so in construction tends to be a lot different than let's call it consumer electronics, right? If you're building an iPhone, it looks pretty small. You can imagine that the automation is going to be a relatively small arm, and it basically is not going to do a lot of, it wouldn't injure you because it's very light payload machine. When you start picking up a 80 to 90 pound board of sheathing, as an example, or picking up studs or complete wall panel that might weigh 500 pounds, you're getting into much larger robots. And now you've got to deal with the reality that someone can get hurt. If it can pick up, if a robot can pick up 500 pounds, that can end up injuring a human being. If that robot was to collide with or enter the zone where the humans are operating. So we went out and looked at what technologies are available for human to machine cooperation. And that's also referred to as collaboration in our market. We use the words interchangeably. And we found out that ABB had the best, what they refer to as safe move technology, which allowed their heavy duty payload robots to work side by side next to operators without the traditional hard barriers. The typical way of using a big, heavy robot was to put a huge fence or a wall between that robot and the operator so that there was never any chance of overlap in the working envelopes, that the human would never enter into the space where the robot is working. But to collaborate and work together, and what I mean by that is, let's say we're framing a floor module and there's a series of fasteners because of the nature of the module that just cannot be reached by the robot. It does not have the dexterity to do it. The human operator would have to go in and put those screws in. And there is going to be this robot towering over and behind this person, waiting for that screw to get put in. And then the robot's going to do its job, which is to put down adhesives and put down heavy boards. In order to be productive, you need to not be opening and closing fences and doors and cages and dungeons. It needs to be an open cooperative environment. So what we did is we teamed up with ABB. They had a series of software that allowed us to use safety laser scanners. And we put laser scanners around our robot. The robots are always, always open and always looking. And always looking for, is there a human nearby me? And if so, the robot says, oh, somebody's entered near me. And it starts to slow down. Or if the person continues to get closer, it says this person is maybe not trained and they're getting too close to me and I'm going to slow down to a very slow speed automatically so that I can't hurt them. And then if they get way too darn close, it's going to go into what they call supervised stop. where the robot just stops in a safe mode until the person backs away. So that's really what we went after, is an automatic collaborative environment where we surround all of our robots with they call dual channel safety scanners that scans the environment around the robots. They're UL certified and tested. They have dual channel technology. So if one channel fails, the second channel kicks in for redundancy. And you will see robots and operators handing parts off in a safe manner, which has never been done before in construction.
That is fascinating. That is, to me, is the future of construction, of all these different video games I've seen over the years. That's that safety handoff. Dave, I'm curious, what have you seen done wrong as you've come in as a CEO of all these fascinating things I'm learning and seeing that you've been working on? What are you seeing that people in offsite are doing wrong in offsite construction?
It's the collaboration. I mean, and I struggle with using the word wrong in any instance when we're talking about what we're doing. And the reason is that a lot of what we're doing, and I'd say 90% of what we're doing, no one else has done before. So there really is no measure. You can't say what's right or wrong until you've done it and failed. Then it's wrong. So it's a lot of trying. And what I'm finding and what I'm seeing is, going through the process of design development, the upfront collaboration, and the value of the input from the field, that and the insight that the design team gets from the field, has been a huge win in righting some of those wrongs, if you will. It's increased communication, increased collaboration by humans on the front end that allows our back end to be successful. To Dwight's point, and delivering it to the field, our on-site labor costs are reduced, our on-site safety issues are reduced dramatically. You don't have saws running all day, every day, cutting metal studs. They're not drilling holes with metal studs. They're not using hydraulic punches to punch holes in the metal studs. All of those are opportunities for somebody to get hurt and take additional time. I think I see more not being, I'd like to see more done in the factory than what's been typically done in the factory. There's a lot of things like the way that we put adhesive on a board, right? It in my mind, it's lay the wall on the floor and put the adhesive on the stud and then lay the plywood in the adhesive. Well, in 3D robot world, it's move the wood underneath a stationary glue tip. The result is, every time we put glue on a board, the bead is exactly 3/8 of an inch, which is what the manufacturer specifies. What happens in the field is the guy smears it, because we're all caught really bad with caulk and glue, right? No one ever does it the way the manufacturer says. Well, the robot's really strong, right? It can pick up that piece of plywood, swing it around like it's nothing, and then runs it underneath the glue gun and turns it upside down and flops it onto the wall exactly where it needs to be, and then screws it off and torques every screw head to specification. That does not happen in the field. And that whole process in the field is, it takes a lot of time. We've done a number of tests, right, where the guys say, well, we can do that faster. And we say, okay, well, let's try it. And we put our guys to task and have them build the same thing that the robots are building and see what the outcome is. And it's remarkable that if we take the time up front and we teach the robot what to do, it can do it faster, safer, and more efficient, while our guys do the things that the robot can't do: loading machines, moving materials around, bringing things to the job site. And now to do a wall on site, instead of having six guys, we can do it with three or four, and get it done faster. So it all goes back to increasing productivity and efficiency on the job site.
And those are some great, great examples of how Dwight at the beginning of this talked about how construction's kind of the last to come into this game, right? Like, the obvious stuff of like, to CYA of the manufacturer says this in the warranty, but the warranty is actually impossible to achieve in the field. So then it becomes this pointing of the finger when us humans are just humans trying to figure this all out to be successful, right? I mean, this has a deep dive series and Art of Construction Tribe. There's a bunch more other talking points of getting into the riches of the niches of how Dwight actually like puts these robots in this overview. We just can't solve all this as we're all in the Art of Construction trying to pick up these pieces to move this forward. But how cool is it as Dwight, one of the biggest things as we go to close this thing out. And it was one of the first comments Dwight said on one of our initial meet and greets as we get into ask the questions that we ask everybody. And Dwight said, Devin, if you do this right with automation, 1 + 1 + 1 is not 3. And I was like, I didn't quite, you know, it's a play on words. And then they talk about their 4-in-1 wall system. I'll leave it that way to close this out for these last questions, that this is the question I'm so fascinated to ask you too, because I've asked this over 250 times. And it's fascinating the answers I get. And people that are not really close to construction will say something like, I don't know, maybe robots will take over the world. You can go back and hear those type of answers for this question. So Dwight, and then I'm going to ask Dave, who's come in and seen this plant and is now living it. Dwight, what is your crystal ball of working with these robots for the last 30 plus years? For the future with technology in construction?
So what I envision, Devin, is that there will remain a factory component to construction in the future. And that's where the kit of parts are made as manufactured components. And that is where I see robotics is going to get better and smarter. To give you an idea, like we put in something like 30,000 fasteners robotically into a product. That's not something that any human being wants to go home and say that they did today, because if they do that every day, they're going to have carpal tunnel, right? So that's a great task for a robot. But one of the things that we're looking at is learning, deep learning within the factory. And what I mean is, if we are going to be putting in materials and fasteners as an example, as a process, or we're going to be getting adhesives that come in and the viscosity is slightly different because it might be colder today in the plant than it was a month ago, or it might have been delivered in a vehicle where the adhesive got cold during transport. The same processes we have today will be driven by artificial intelligence. And I call that industry 4.0, all right, the fourth industrial revolution, in which big data drives the improvement of the manufacturing process within the plant. We gather every single bit of screw installation data on our framed walls. We know the height of the screw, the torque of the screw, how long it put in each screw. So if I've been putting screws in at 2.6 seconds for the last week, and all of a sudden it takes 3.1, but the screw still went in. Okay, still went in. It was half a second longer. The average manufacturing plant says, let's keep it running. A data-driven manufacturing plant says, that is an anomaly. Something is happening and something is going to happen, because why would it have taken 3 seconds instead of 2.6? And then you get into this preventive, predictive maintenance and intervention into the manufacturing process. So I think it's going to be AI-driven deep learning inside the plant, where robots will actually look at anomalies. They will look at what they do every day and say something's not right, and they will make adaptations to their own process, their points, their processes, their screw guns, their dispensing systems automatically based upon big data being collected within the offsite construction plant. Now, in the job site, I expect that you will see more and more robotic automation moving into that, but they'll be different than what you see in a plant. And some of those are quite interesting today, like the robots that have been developed to do the chalk line layouts for wall panels, so that the robot walks along the slab in a commercial building and dispenses chalk lines, so that in the morning, the crew that installs the panels do not have to spend the first day laying out chalk lines. So you're going to see more of those types of job site assistance tools being done with service robotics instead of more conventional industrial robotics like you have in a plant. And of course, you're going to see more of the laser and optical based technologies. Today, we fly a drone over a lot, and the drone tells us where the earth movers need to move to fill the civil plan drawing outs to meet the grading patterns. We don't do it anymore. The robots are basically flying overhead as we're moving dirt. So I think you're going to see more and more service-based robotics at the job site, specific niche applications like you're seeing today, and you're going to see more artificial intelligence, data driven by big data, industry 4.0 type solutions within the plant.
Fascinating. It's just fascinating. What an answer. And if I hear you right, you're saying a robot's excited to put in 50,000 screws a day. And if you just maintain that robot, it's actually going to give you information back to do that even better versus a person doing that you're not going to find, and you're going to have a hard time keeping them to say, I want to be better at putting in 50,000 screws a day.
Yeah, exactly. You want to get better at it every day. They're like, you want me to be better at this? I don't even want to do this job. Okay.
Dave, I'm sure you've been like me. I can only imagine as the CFO of these fascinating minds of you actually doing that. But same question for you. What is your crystal ball for the future with technology and construction?
That's a great question. So my answer is I'm kind of living it, right?
When I say the future is now, fascinating for me to be have you come in. And that's why I really wanted you to be in here, is like, we're all students of the game, but we all have different parts of figuring it out, right? Of all coming together.
So you know, my job at Offsite Tech is to deliver our product to our customer. And I face the customer most of the time. And to see the reaction of our clients when they walk back there is pretty cool, right? Because everybody's jaw kind of drops and they're like, this is Star Trek. And to Dwight's point, no, it's really not. It's a muted manufacturing plant. We could do more, but does it make sense to do more is kind of the question, you know, we had to ask ourselves. And, you know, to answer the question, I totally agree with what Dwight said. And big data is driving decisions in the construction world in a multitude of ways that aren't being utilized in a physical build, right? We do it in design in the mechanical space a lot, particularly when you're in big projects like power plants and hospitals and universities, where mechanical coordination is critical. You know, BIM functioning in that space is a reality. It's just now getting to the point where we're able to use it in a more meaningful way to deliver buildings in a cost effective and efficient way. And you know, I think that it will be a sort of an evolution or revolution, if you will, in the industry. And I think that the early adopters are going to be surprising. I think that you'll see a lot of the larger construction companies adopting this technology faster than anyone can anticipate. So I am living it. Our future is now.
And the last question for you, Dave, what is that one thing you want to leave contractors and our affiliates to think about to go out there and crush it to grow their business?
Stay the course. You know, believe in your team and give them the support they need.
Outstanding. And to close this thing out, Dwight, thank you so much for all this information. And we're such big fans of what you guys are doing. What's that one thing you want to leave everybody thinking about to go out there and have as much fun as possible and get involved in what Offsite Tech is doing?
I like to say what Mandela said. It all appears to be impossible until it's done. And don't be afraid of just going out and doing great things. And I think the best way to do it is to say, let's go out and, you know, build the world in a different way, but do it together, right? It's about together and collaboration. It's not just technology collaboration. It's also about finding the right partners and to collaborate with, because that's how you're going to accelerate getting the improvements done.
Gold. Guys, thank you so much for coming and sharing your story, and big things ahead, and we can't wait to see the future of offsite tech. Thanks, guys.